Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Michael, have you got a minute?
Michael, please don't save the car.
Toto?
Yes.
We fought a motor race, okay? Toto, we went to car racing.
Could a Mercedes comeback be on the horizon?
And it was O Canada for Mr. Verstappen.
Canada, oh Canada, oh how we have missed you.
Lights out and away we go, and Max Verstappen gets the better start from Fernando Alonso, and Lewis Hamilton away quickly too.
Under the engine.
Oh, this is epically bad. For Sergio Perez, he is out of the race. Virtual safety car.
Ferrari are going to make a stop. Looks like Red Bull are coming out as well.
Hamilton will get a decent exit and is racing Ocon now down towards turn one. As Charles Leclerc has Daniel Ricciardo as the next car he wants to try and overtake. And that's why we've got yellow flags. Yuki Tsunoda in the AlphaTauri.
Sorry, I'm out.
Safety car. This has absolutely worked in Carlos Sainz's favour. When does Verstappen want to release the rest of the pack? And Carlos Sainz has gone right with him as well. That is Fernando Alonso getting passed by Charles Leclerc. Max Verstappen can just start to relax and to rest a little bit to win the Canadian Grand Prix.
We're loving the O Canada today, chaps. Hello, I'm Shannon Mabry, your host of the Race Directors podcast. And I'm joined by the soon-to-be blue flag backmarkers, F1 journalist Ed Spencer and serial podcaster Joe Spagnoli. Mysterious F1 Twitter menace unpaid intern is, yes, still doing his paid interning, but rest assured he will be back with us in a couple of weeks. Now, chaps, did we enjoy O Canada? How did we feel about the race? I thought it was okay, I guess. Ed, why don't you start?
Just like some of these races this year, a bit of a slow burner. I would say it really caught a light within the last 20 laps when the safety car came out after Tsunoda's rather bizarre accident coming out of the pits. But I thought it was a fairly okay race, to be honest with you. I think there was no one really going to stop Verstappen. He'd been flawless all weekend, and I don't think anyone else was going to win that race, unless your name was not Max Verstappen. So, yeah, good result for him, good result for Carlos Sainz, P2, although he'll be wondering why didn't he attack in the last few laps and try and snatch the win. And also good result for Mercedes. Finally, they get something back after what had been a miserable start to the season. McLaren, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. Please remember to get the tyres out next time.
I loved it, personally. It was my favourite Grand Prix probably since at least Melbourne, maybe even Jeddah. I'm just really, really happy to see this venue back. I love the intrigue of the different strategies, the safety car period as well, which neither Red Bull nor Ferrari were particularly happy about, the slow decision from Eduardo Freitas to put the full safety car out there. But no, it may have been a slow burner for a race, but 70 laps, they went by pretty damn quickly, and just another reason why I'm very glad that this track is going to be on the F1 calendar for a very long time.
I will agree with you there, actually. It was really nice to be back in Canada, and there were some really enjoyable parts of the race, and certainly a little bit of drama. Lots of very rubbish pit stops, which has obviously left a lot of people at the edge of their seats and rather disappointed, because it certainly wasn't a good week for Charles Leclerc at all. Once again, really, really bad time from him. Quite a disappointing result, I think, as well. Joe, as our resident Italian, how are you feeling about Charles, about Carlos, about Ferrari's overall performance of the weekend?
I'm kind of with Ed earlier. I don't think anyone other than Max Verstappen was going to win that race. And even if he hadn't had the straight line speed of the Red Bull, his runs through the wall of champions all weekend were just so perfect that there was no chance of Sainz getting through either at the first straight or the second DRS zone straight. As for Leclerc, obviously they're only starting towards the back through Ferrari's own terrible power unit issues at the last round. They've already replaced every component but the energy store, and I think four of them are beyond the season limit already, so that's a lot of penalties still to come, let alone this weekend. I thought he personally did a very good job of coming through the field, but Ferrari didn't help themselves. I was checking out the deltas towards the end of Leclerc's first stint. He'd started on the hard, he'd been stuck behind Ocon, but they were gradually pulling ahead of Lance Stroll and the DRS train behind him. And I even said it to the people I was watching it with. All they need to do now, have a good stop, slightly below the average pit stop time, and he comes out ahead of this train. One good pit stop was all Ferrari needed, but they screwed it up. They had a problem with the jacks, cost them 2.5 seconds, and that was the difference. He could have come out ahead of Lance Stroll. In the end, he came out behind not only Stroll, but the three cars that were behind him. Without having to overtake that entire DRS train, Charles Leclerc could have been on for a podium after that safety car restart. And again, who is to blame? No one but Ferrari themselves.
Yeah, they're not having a good time of it, are they? But let's talk Red Bull for a minute, because I feel like for them it was very much a mixed bag of a weekend. Great result for Max Verstappen. He looked absolutely unstoppable. His times compared to everyone else in qualifying were just blisteringly quick. I couldn't quite fathom how much faster he was than everyone else in Q3. But then on the flip side, you've got Checo Perez, who had a reliability issue yet again and was not able to finish the race. So it's very much a 50-50 win-lose for Red Bull. Ed, how do you feel about how it went for Checo? I was absolutely gutted to see him out.
Well, he looked good in practice. He was right up there with Verstappen. But unfortunately, it was a mistake of his own doing by simply going too hot into the corner and beating it. And yes, he was trying to get reversed, but trying to reverse one of these cars is... It's almost like trying to climb Mont Ventoux 2 with a wheelbarrow of horse manure. It's nearly impossible. And from then on in, he would have an uphill task. And unfortunately, he wasn't able to fulfil it in the race. It's big bad news for his championship challenge because of the fact that Charles got a good haul. Max won the race, obviously, and he didn't get anything. So, yeah, everything that could go wrong for Checo did go wrong this weekend. And I think he's going to be hurting a lot going to Silverstone. But this is a circuit he doesn't do particularly bad at, so we'll see. There's plenty of time to rebound. This season is still, as I say, very young, and anything can happen in Formula One, and it usually does.
So we're less than halfway through the season now. You don't think his championship hopes are dead in the water, though?
No, it's not over till the rather chunky race director waves the checkered flag in Abu Dhabi. That's what I would say.
You love that one. You absolutely love it. But let's talk about Mercedes, because I feel like it was a super positive weekend for them. Hamilton in third, Russell in fourth. Really amazing to see Lewis Hamilton back on the podium for the first time since the start of the season. He was obviously very happy about it as well after saying, I think it was on Friday, although maybe someone can correct me. Oh, this car is so bad. Was that Friday he said that? He was really down on Friday about that car. And then lo and behold, he ends up on the podium in typical Lewis Hamilton fashion. Joe, thoughts on Mercedes? Because it feels like they could maybe be back in the game.
It was the weekend that Hamilton needed, and make no mistake, it would have been a major story if George Russell had been able to out-qualify and out-finish Lewis around this track in particular, which I think statistically is his second most successful, even more so than Silverstone, which of course is the next venue. It's just another one of those weekends for Mercedes where they are the third fastest car. We all know they're the third fastest car. And yet for the whole of Friday, we're thinking, are they? Are they even in the top half of the field, realistically? You've got at least one of the drivers complaining about it. And yet they come out of the weekend, and not only have they managed to get a car on the podium, but they've completely outfinished Alpine, who have been the team constantly nipping at Mercedes' heels all year in terms of pace, but never seem to string it together. How many podiums do Mercedes have now overall? It's like 4 or 5 podiums between the two drivers. Alpine haven't even got a single top five yet. Mercedes, for all their issues, they're very, very good at stringing together a good race weekend.
Very much agreed. But let's talk also about Alfa Romeo, if we're going to talk about teams doing well. because you had Bottas in seventh and Zhou in eighth. I mean, hello, Alfa Romeo. I feel like they started off really strong, lagged a little bit, but it was really nice to see, especially Guan Yu Zhou back in the points after scoring points in his debut race. I thought it was a fantastic showing from Alfa Romeo this weekend. I was absolutely chuffed to see it. Ed?
Yeah, I would agree. It was a good performance from Alfa Romeo. And a good time as well, because after the highs of Spain, things had not been looking too good for them. So, yeah, they looked strong throughout the weekend. Bottas had a really good drive. And Zhou, in particular, arguably his best weekend in Formula One so far. He looked very smooth, very calm under pressure. His qualifying was good. His race was good. Deserved P8, although, you know, he finished P9 originally, only for Alonso to be penalised, so he got promoted. But yeah, it's definitely what Alfa Romeo needed. And I will say it again, that car will be on the podium at some stage this year. I just think that Bottas or Zhou will get it on the podium. It's not a slouch. Alpine have kind of dropped the ball a little bit in the fact that they messed up the strategy for Alonso. So Alfa could be in the hunt for fifth. And yeah, I would say it's a fairly good weekend's effort. Also, Zebi Pujolar jumped in the rather freezing cold Montreal lake after getting their double points. So all smiles for Alfa Romeo, albeit very soggy ones.
Alfa Romeo podium, I can believe that. I can get behind that 100%. But we can't be positive all the time. So maybe we should be talking about some of the negatives now and things that make me very, very sad. I think you know what we're going to talk about. It's McLaren. That was horrendous. My goodness. Ricciardo in 11th. Lando Norris finishing 15th, only probably for the grace of the fact that three people DNF'd. Absolutely horrendous show, I think, this weekend from McLaren. And that double stack pit stop where no one knew what tyres to put on Lando Norris's car. My God, that was extremely painful and embarrassing to watch. And it's just not what we expect. Even if they are struggling this year, we don't expect to see both McLaren drivers finishing outside of the points. And that, especially having Lando Norris so low down in the ranks as well. And I know that he was having engine problems this weekend. But even so, it just seemed, even to see Daniel Ricciardo outperforming Lando, it didn't feel like an achievement, really, when you're finishing in 11th. But Joe, embarrassing, horrendous, bad. What do you think?
Lando had been having issues all weekend, as far as I'm aware. I think they were turbo-related. I know Will Joseph was trying to get him to do, I think it was Lando who was trying to get to do burnouts in the pit lane just to see if the power unit was all working in harmony. And over the course of the weekend, it's fair to say it wasn't. The car was having issues relative even to Ricciardo's. And we know that the McLaren's not particularly great in a straight line. So around a track like Canada, you really need to be on the best of your game. And the big difference between McLaren in the first half of last season, think about, you know, the podium at Imola, how brilliant Norris was until the summer break, was that McLaren were incredibly well drilled, not only in strategy, but also pit stop timing. That's just something they haven't got this year. There's been a lot of talk about how much they screwed over Daniel Ricciardo on multiple stints in Baku. Same could be said about Norris this time, and that double stack, Shannon. McLaren can be quite thankful that they haven't got a competitive car this year, because if that was Ferrari doing that, if that was Red Bull doing that, we'd still be talking about that incident next season, because it's so embarrassing. That lack of preparation is something that fundamentally should not be happening at the highest level of open wheel racing. And it's just another weekend we come out of it. I still don't know where McLaren sit in the performance rankings. I would say sixth, but some weekends they're as high as fourth. It's impossible to tell because they just lack
facts.
Consistency.
Straight facts. And I think they've actually been one of the best teams this year for pit stops after historically being quite average. They've had some of the fastest pit stop times this season. So it's shocking to see that from them, honestly. And I would agree, it's really hard to tell where they sit at the moment because it's so inconsistent between tracks. It really seems that their performance is probably a good 80-90% track dependent at the moment. And at a track that agrees with their car, they do extremely well. At a track that doesn't, you'd think they were Williams or last year's Alfa Romeo. It's just, it's very inconsistent and I think quite disappointing. But if we're going to talk about disappointments, let's talk about Aston Martin and seeing Seb Vettel finish in 12th in Canada, which I don't think anyone was expecting. I was almost expecting him to have at least a top 10, maybe even a top 5 finish, because he loves this track. But Ed, were you quite disappointed to see him out of the points?
I was surprised, if I'm being honest with you. They look quick in practice, but in qualifying, it just went all horribly wrong. Even if in FP3, Sebastian was in the top 3. So, yeah, I was very surprised to see him go out in Q1. And, of course, in the race, it was damage limitation for him. And I think with the fact that they had quicker cars behind him, it was just going to be a difficult race. And, unfortunately, P12 is all that he could muster. On the other side of the garage, it was a completely positive weekend because Lance Stroll got a point on home soil, which, you know, considering that he had a rough run of races, it's kind of what he needed. Because there were some feelings that, you know, is Stroll losing his mojo, and now he's, you know, back in the points playing positions. But yeah, not a good weekend for Aston Martin, not a good weekend for Vettel, not of his own doing, of course, in my opinion. I just don't think, you know, that car has, you know, really got it in the sense. It's definitely improvement on its elder brother. It's still the 7th, 8th best car on the grid at the moment.
Agreed. And I think probably a similar story could be told for AlphaTauri this week. Very disappointing results with Tsunoda ending up in the wall. Gasly finishing 14th ahead of Norris. Just Gasly's having a real, real tough season this year, I feel like. We were so excited about him last year and he was performing incredibly well. But this year it's not looking so great. And a lot of his races have been quite forgettable for me. I feel like we barely see anything from him. And when you have a look to see in the finishing lineup where he's finished, it's another very disappointing race for him. Whereas last year it was, you know, 5th, 6th, he was always finishing in the points. So feeling for Pierre Gasly this year, because 2022 doesn't seem to be doing him any favors. Joe, thoughts on Pierre Gasly? We won't talk about Tsunoda because he ended up in the wall.
There's nothing to say about Tsunoda other than that is 100% on him. And he fundamentally, well, he could have changed the way the race went for the senior team, let alone AlphaTauri. It's so frustrating being a sort of Gasly fan to see how much is going against him. But the lack of attention is kind of inevitable when you go from having the 5th or 6th, maybe even 4th fastest car, often challenging for points, to a car that really, really can't. The AlphaTauri is probably 8th on average this year, and at Canada it may well have been even worse. That's just what happens. There's less TV attention on you, and an impressive performance for Pierre Gasly now is 11th or 12th in that car. Last year it was 4th at Zandvoort, 5th elsewhere, a sneaky podium at Baku. That's naturally going to get a lot more attention. But yeah, I think Pierre Gasly and Guan Yu Zhou are probably the two drivers that are getting the least attention this year, in part because they're actually not doing anything wrong. They're just let down either by ill circumstance or, in the case of Gasly, a car that has regressed massively versus what AlphaTauri had last year.
Now, we would be remiss not to talk about our other resident Canadian on the grid, and that is Nicholas Latifi. Rumours flying around all weekend that this was going to be his last race. What a slap in the face that would be to sack someone immediately after their home race. But do we think that that's actually on the horizon? I mean, he finished 16th. The only person that finished behind him was Kevin Magnussen. Do we think they are actually going to sack him this week? Or is that just grid gossip? Ed, what do you think?
Well, he says he's going to finish out the season, which I don't know. Racing drivers say one thing and team bosses say the other. And Oscar Piastri, who's rumored to be replacing him, is said to be, his chances of racing this year are very slim. So I think he'll do this end of the season and then they'll say bye-bye. I just don't see the rhyme and reason of sacking a driver midway through the season to throw a guy in who hasn't got the experience. And this is no disrespect to Oscar Piastri, but I don't think throwing him in at the deep end and saying go and beat Alex Albon after no testing is a particularly good idea. You might as well finish the season out, give Piastri enough preparation so when it comes to 2023, he's ready to go. And so, yeah, I think it's best just to keep him going, keep him for the rest of the season, give him a proper farewell, and then say au revoir.
Could be. Joe, do you think he's on his way out, or do you think he's staying on?
I just have to aggregate all my sources, one of which, of course, is Ed Spencer, and Oscar Piastri saying is a slim chance of him racing this year. It just seems, I think I said this last week, particularly unusual to get rid of him after this race. If they're going to make a change, I would have expected it slightly later at the half-season break. But the worrying thing yet again with Latifi was just how far off the pace of Alexander Albon was. Granted, he hasn't raced here in Formula One before, but it's little excuse because it's not like Albon's been racing here recently. And Albon, to my knowledge, had only raced here once in Formula One anyway. So it's hardly like you're going up against a Raikkonen or an Alonso. It's becoming increasingly difficult to defend Latifi's position in that team. But again, I can't see them doing it this early. But the thing is with Williams, they do have a car that with an amazing strategy and a virtuoso performance, it can finish in the points this year. It's not like, say, Russell's first 2 years. And if there's any points up for grabs, you have to have the right driver for it. And Nicholas Latifi, there's nothing to suggest after this weekend, or indeed any weekend this year, that he's going to be challenging for points anytime soon.
A very fair point, well made. But gentlemen, it's time to go for a grid walk down my favourite grid, and that is Gossip Grid. Welcome to Gossip Grid, the part of the podcast where I impart unto you, dear listeners, the latest whispers flying around the paddock. Word on the grid is that things got heated between Toto Wolff, Christian Horner and Mattia Binotto in a meeting about porpoising this weekend, with Wolff reportedly getting quite angry. After the meeting, Toto Wolff publicly called out certain, quote, pitiful team bosses, accusing them of being two-faced and only looking to preserve their competitive advantage. And the real kicker? All of this supposedly took place in front of Netflix cameras. Looks like the next season of Drive to Survive will be interesting. Hell, they can probably make 3 episodes out of this alone. And according to Moroccan F1 fans and multiple sources in Morocco, Morocco might enter contention versus South Africa to host a Grand Prix on the African continent. According to multiple sources close to the Moroccan government, about $500 million was withdrawn from the Ministry of Finance funds. Could we see a face-off for the face of the African continent in F1? Time will tell. That's all the gossip I have for you this week, dear listeners, but rest assured, my ears are always open. So, gentlemen, Moroccan Grand Prix, possibly? Is this something that you guys have been hearing? Any whispers that you've heard in the media room, Ed?
No, not really, although there was a brief rumour at the start of the year. I would be happy with it. Whilst Morocco looks increasingly likely to get a slot on the F1 calendar, Spa is looking potentially on the ropes. Apparently, they are still struggling with the contract with F1 and Spa-Francorchamps, so we could be losing Spa for a long time if it falls off the calendar. Also, the French Grand Prix has been back in the news, and this time there is a round potentially going to be held in Nice in July. Frédéric Ferrer from L'Equipe spoke with Domenicali over the Montreal weekend, and they announced a proposal, which apparently the mayor of Nice also has a link with Paul Ricard. So, yeah, good time for the French Grand Prix, potentially, that it could have a much older, younger brother to Monte Carlo.
I have been hearing about this Nice Grand Prix as well, and it does sound fairly exciting. But Joe, how do you feel about the rumours that your team boss, Mattia Binotto, got apparently very angry in this argument with Toto Wolff and Christian Horner? Because I feel like he's usually a very calm man. I can't imagine what Toto could have said that would have got Mattia Binotto in a flap.
See, I object to being characterised, A, as a diehard Tifosi, and B, as someone in any way involved with Scuderia Ferrari. However, I have to press X to doubt on this occasion because I can't imagine Mattia Binotto getting angry or particularly heated at anything. I've seen interviews with this guy ever since the mid-2000s, the days where he couldn't speak English. And even in native Italian, a language that makes anger look so much more beautiful, even then he looked incredibly calm. So whatever Netflix have covered is going to be a massive exclusive and culture shock for me. But it's just really unusual, the two teams that are at loggerheads in both championships, or at least they were before Ferrari decided to Ferrari themselves, are now basically on the same side against a Mercedes that could not be less relevant at the moment in the constructors' battle. So yeah, very, very unusual. And I look forward, as you said on Gossip Grid, to this this occupying half of Drive to Survive Season 5.
At least 3 episodes, minimum, I guarantee it. And I do apologise for stereotyping you, Joe, as our resident Italian, as being a Scuderia super fan. I am sorry. But out of the present and into the past, it's time to look back with Ed Spencer. Now, we all know Silverstone has a very large and boisterous crowd, but they are also extremely helpful in giving the first indication that you are gaining on the car in front of you. Here's Ed with the first example of how people power helped Nigel Mansell take a crucial second British Grand Prix win.
We all know how people power can do anything, from overturning crucial aspects of daily life to winning home an athlete when they look to be tiring in the final throes of competition. When the chips look down for Nigel Mansell, his loyal disciples willed him on as he managed to overcome a gap of over 20 seconds to beat his rival Nelson Piquet to victory. Here's the story of how Mansell used people power to his advantage. It's the story of Silverstone in 87.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
After just under a year away, Formula One returned to Silverstone for what looks set to be a showdown between the two Williams drivers, Nelson Piquet, and the man whom 95% of the fans on hand at Silverstone came to see, Nigel Mansell. But neither were leading the championship at that point of the season, as Lotus's Ayrton Senna held a one-point lead over Alain Prost, with Piquet third, 3 points back on his countryman, whilst Mansell lay in fourth, 6 points back after taking victory in France. The top four locked out the first two rows of the grid, with Piquet taking the pole by just 0.07 of a second, with Senna and Prost on row two, but over a second down on the Williams pair. Piercarlo Ghinzani wouldn't start from 19th after getting a push from his Ligier team after running out of fuel in qualifying. The race officials took a dim view of this and threw the Italian out of the race.
Go! Piquet blasts away, Prost comes up, right alongside Mansell, and Prost leads into Copse,
where Piquet went round the outside of Prost to lead onto Hangar Straight, with the Frenchman quickly losing second to Mansell as the field roared through to complete lap one. Prost continued to be shuffled back on lap two, with Senna getting past to go into third place, with Thierry Boutsen now breathing down the Frenchman's neck as he looked to relegate the reigning world champion to fifth. Lap three saw the first two retirements of the race, with René Arnoux giving his Ligier mechanics a chance to catch the last ferry back home with an electrical failure, whilst Ivan Capelli's Ford V8 caught a blaze, putting him out. Whilst the cameras watched Capelli's Ford V8 turn into an open-air barbecue, Prost repassed Senna for third at Copse on lap 5, whilst Gerhard Berger was the first of the big players to be eliminated for a crash on lap 7, just as Philippe Alliot parked his Lola Ford with a gearbox failure. Andrea De Cesaris gave Brabham's sponsor some unwanted airtime with a turbo fire on lap 8, earning him his fifth retirement of what was turning out to be a season of disappointment for the Bernie Ecclestone-run team. Alessandro Nannini also retired on lap 10, although he retired with an engine failure. As the race settled down, the top six began slicing through the normally aspirated back markers, with Piquet holding a comfortable lead from Mansell, Prost, Senna, Alboreto and Johansson.
Piquet, Back for him in the lead, with Mansell just going through in the background, just lapping one of the Sir cars. And things really look very comfortable indeed for the Williams team. Prost has dropped back a little bit.
Prost was the first to stop for tyres on lap 30, with the McLaren team getting their man back out in just over 8 seconds as he rejoined behind Alboreto. As the Williams pair approached half distance, the lead was just over a second. But when coming up to lap Lotus's Satoru Nakajima, the Japanese rookie balked Mansell after letting Piquet glide by, costing Mansell precious time as he managed to squeeze past the Japanese rookie at the chicane. Meanwhile, further down the order, Christian Danner's day came to an end on lap 32 with a gearbox issue. Max Caffey's good run in 14th ended with an Alfa Romeo engine failure, whilst Adrian Campos ended Minardi's day on lap 34 with a fuel system failure, as Mansell pitted for tyres on lap 34 after picking up a vibration.
Nigel Mansell is coming in, and it's going to be critical, his time compared with that of Nelson Piquet.
The Brit got out in just under 10 seconds, as he tried to overhaul the 28-second gap by breaking the Silverstone lap record on multiple occasions, as he sliced through the traffic like a hot knife through butter. Many wondered whether Piquet would stop, but with 22 laps to go, he was told to stay out by his Williams team, who told the Brazilian that his tyres were okay, and that he could go the distance on his current set as Chiva retired with a smoky Megatron engine. But Mansell was on another planet, consistently breaking the lap record as the Brit was willed on by his partisan fans, as he relentlessly pursued his teammate, who was now getting a taste of his own traffic medicine as he was now caught in a Tyrrell sandwich on the run down to Beckett.
And Mansell isn't far off schedule to catch Nelson. There are 18 laps to go and he's 18 seconds behind him. So he's on schedule to catch him just about on the last lap as things go at the moment. And Nigel really charging with his chase.
Prost's once promising race came to an end on lap 53 when his tag engine gave up the ghost, promoting Senna onto the podium as he tried to remain on the lead lap. By now, Mansell was breaking into the 1 minute nines, and with the gap now down to over 6 seconds, the boisterous British crowd along with Mansell could taste an unlikely victory, as he came to lap Senna with relative ease as Piquet's lead was now virtually wiped out. With just 3 laps to go.
And this is where Mansell will be looking to challenge. Piquet will hold the inside line. Oh! And Mansell through.
Overcoming a 25 second gap to kickstart his championship campaign, with Piquet a disconsolate second ahead of Senna, Nakajima, Derek Warwick and Thierry Boutsen. At the end of the race, the fans broke ranks and invaded the track, with Mansell now on foot after his Honda engine blew up on the cooldown lap. He was given a hero's welcome as he picked up his second British Grand Prix trophy. He would later thank the fans for their support, as their cheering and waving gave him the first indication that he was gaining on Piquet. However, Mansell would have to wait 5 more years to take his maiden championship, as Piquet took his 3rd world title after the Brit was ruled out of the Japanese Grand Prix as a result of a back injury in practice. Silverstone 1987 was arguably Mansell's finest performance in a Grand Prix car. But it was also the day when people power played a hand in deciding the fate of the race.
It's fair to say that Lewis Hamilton will be hoping for a bit of people power next Sunday when we come back to Silverstone for the British Grand Prix. So let's see what will happen next time in the 2022 edition of the British Grand Prix.
I'd argue there's a fundamental difference in having, say, Nelson Piquet, whom the British crowd absolutely hated, or Nico Rosberg, who the British crowd absolutely hated, versus George Russell, who they absolutely adore. Like, this is the first time in a long time where Lewis Hamilton is going to come to the British Grand Prix and a genuine majority of the spectators are also going to love his teammate, who is, by all accounts, still in incredible form. George Russell has still finished top 5 at every round this year.
I don't call him Mr. Consistency for nothing.
You're right, he is on an incredible run. Absolutely incredible, Joe. And hopefully he can keep up in Silverstone. And I think you're right. Lewis is definitely going to see probably the most support at a race that he's seen for a while. I think he obviously has a lot of support in the UK anyway, a lot of British fans. But I think the fact that he is in more of an underdog place right now will no doubt warm a lot more people to his cause, perhaps, than when he was super dominant. because that's what we're like as a human race, isn't it? We love an underdog. We love when people aren't doing well so that we can get behind them. So I wouldn't be surprised if he sees even more than the normal amount of support at Silverstone this week. But back into the present day, chaps, it is time for news of the week. So I want to know, what is your news of the week? And we'll kick off with you, Mr. Spencer.
Well, the biggest news of the week was obviously Pierre Gasly being confirmed to AlphaTauri for 2023. A lot of people did think there was a slight chance that he would be going to McLaren. Aston Martin, particularly Sebastian Vettel, did retire. But Francis Toll dispelled all those rumours by announcing in the Saturday press conference that Gasly would be retained for 2023. So that really effectively kills silly season off before it even starts.
Very true, very true. Although I think we're all still hoping for a little bit of a silly season this year. We do love it, really. We love the chaos. But Joe, what is your news item of the week?
I went, just, Roy Fields, you can cut this. Ed, I told you before the podcast started, that was my story. Oh, so fuck bollocks. You for stealing it. Anyway. Twat, seriously. Hold on, I have another one because I'm ultra diligent. Well, Ed says he's already killed silly season before it's even started, so I'd like to shove even more superfluous nails in the coffin. The other potential seat would, of course, be where the hell is Oscar Piastri going to go? The 2021 Formula 2 champion won it in his rookie season. Incredible form by any standards for a junior driver. It is now looking all but certain that Williams have been able to negotiate with the Alpine driver program to now have two lone drivers for next year. Alex Albon to be partnered with Oscar Piastri ahead of the 2023 Formula One season. The source for this is, you know, it's pretty obvious. They asked Otmar Szafnauer, will Oscar Piastri be in Formula One next year? To which his answer quite quickly was simply, yes. So Latifi's days are numbered.
Damn, no more Gotifi. Almost confirmed. What a life. I think we all knew it was coming, though. But my news item of the week was actually also stolen by Ed Spencer, although I won't get too angry about it because I didn't tell him I was going to talk about it. But it is the news of a possible Grand Prix in Nice, which we have already discussed. And I think it is very exciting and it would probably be a lovely setting. But we shan't dwell on it, chaps, because we've already discussed it. And it's time to jump back into the past with classic teams of F1 lore. With Joe Spagnoli. Now, we at The Race Directors are deliberately not your dad's F1 podcast. All three of us are under the age of 30, and we know a majority of you are too, which is why, of all the teams we could have chosen, Joe's picked one that started in 1954.
You're going to have to forgive me for sounding like a massive Telegraph reader this week, but ahead of the British Grand Prix, and in what is episode 007 of the classic teams, a look back to the original Aston Martin would have been a convenient way to insert British Racing Green at any opportunity. But Aston Martin's first foray into Grand Prix racing was an absolute disaster. They didn't have a single win. Apparently some things never change. But in the earliest years of Formula One, there was a team decked out in green that basically launched British engineering to the top of this sport. So here's a little story about a certain Van Wall. Industrialist Guy Anthony Vandevelle brought attention everywhere he went, be it his marital problems, falling out with friends, or coming across as a, quote, tough nut, spoiling for a fight. But the man was a smart motor racing operator, and after becoming dissatisfied with the management of the BRM team he was financing, Tony set up his own team in the English capital. In a move that was somehow even more pragmatic than it sounds patriotic, Vandevelle brought in both Norton Motorcycles and a certain Rolls-Royce as engine consultants, and behind the task of modifying Grand Prix Ferraris, the team were creating some truly innovative concepts, not least Dunlop's disc brakes. In 1954, these concepts and an in-house engine were put into a special chassis from Cooper, dubbed the Van Wall Special, and set loose in limited F1 appearances. The ambitious car was unreliable, though, and even if Peter Collins and Mike Hawthorn had seen the chequered flag, they'd have been miles behind the dominant Mercedes and Italian giants of Alfa Romeo, Maserati, and Ferrari. Even without Mercedes in 1956, the Tricolore empires needed design geniuses to be beaten, which is why Vandevelle established his young team of Frank Costin for bodywork, Harry Westlake for the cylinders, and Juan Colin Chapman as lead designer for the Van Wall car. Their 1956 lineup couldn't extract the maximum from a troublesome car rife with potential, but the team kept improving their concept, and by 57, Van Wall not only had the fastest car on the grid in a straight line, but an all-British, all-star lineup of Tony Brooks, Stuart Lewis Evans, and the legendary Stirling Moss. An early Monaco podium for Brooks came between frustrating retirements, but by the time F1 reached the British Grand Prix at Aintree, everyone knew what the Van Walls could do. Moss led from pole position, and everything was looking perfect, until his Van Wall engine gave way yet again. Luckily though, this was F1 in the 1950s, a very different era, so Brooks brought the second car into the pits and handed it over to Moss, who set off on one of his most legendary comeback drives.
Moss was back in the race, but the delay had put him in ninth place. Berra in the Maserati now led the field as Moss set off in pursuit. One by one, he overhauled his rivals, and shattering the lap record four times, finally went to the front once more. Setting up a commanding lead, Moss came in to take on 10 gallons of fuel and a bottle of pop in 27 seconds. Some going.
The first Formula One victory for a British car came at the British Grand Prix with not one, but two British drivers. Van Wall had the whole sport talking, and while Fangio roared on to win the Drivers' Championship, Moss was the man in form, winning not only F1's only ever race in Pescara, but the season finale in the Italians' backyard of Monza. For 1958, there was no reason to change drivers, and with the Van Wall VW5 performing better than ever, a full assault on the championship became the focus. After almost winning in Monaco, Moss dominated at Zandvoort.
Moss is storming ahead in the championship, and if the Van Wall can maintain reliability, it has a good chance in the next race at Spa. And it's Moss who leads into the first corner. Charging hard on the first lap, Stirling misses a gear change from fourth to fifth and over revs. A valve touches, and the Van Wall can but trickle forlornly back to the pit lane. Tony Brooks takes over the lead in the remaining Van Wall.
Moss and Brooks won three races each in 1958, and although the former had the outright pace, Ferrari's Mike Hawthorn had reliability. He suffered only two DNFs to Moss's five, and despite a final round win on the streets of Casablanca, Moss and Van Wall lost the Drivers' Championship by a single point. However, 1958 had also brought in a new invention, the World Championship for Constructors. Ferrari may blame quirks in the point system, but their two wins to Van Wall's six spelled out the inevitable. The first official constructor's crown in a sport hitherto dominated by Italian brands went to a British team. It's such a shame what happened next. A combination of regulation changes and the declining health of Tony Vandevelde all but eliminated the team's involvement in Formula One, and Tony Brooks only entered two more races for Van Wall, finishing neither, and the team were never seen again in Formula One after 1960. Despite this, though, the men behind the title did go on to even greater things. But while Chapman and Costin revolutionised Grand Prix racing with the classic Team Lotus, we mustn't forget that everything started with the dark green Van Wall's. And I know I sound like I've got the Union Jack coming out of every single orifice, but it can't be overstated just how important Van Wall were at the time, especially considering what I didn't even realise about Grand Prix racing in the 1950s. So many teams were reliant on privateers. Like Maserati was selling 30 250Fs, I think it was, to privateers around the world. Van Wall, it was just them. They didn't sell those cars to anybody. Like a relatively tiny team using the old factories. And yet the first ever British manufacturer to win in Formula One with a car that, as I've made abundantly clear, couldn't have been any more British.
You do sound like a massive telegraph reader. You're absolutely right, Joe. I'm envisioning Union Jacks and English flags all over your house, sticking out of your window, coming off of your car.
If you think those vibes are strong already, then you won't be happy to learn that basically over the course of researching that piece, I finally came to understand just how bloody amazing Sir Stirling Moss was as a driver. I think Ed said in the past to me that Mike Hawthorn is, quote, the most undeserving or least deserving F1 champion of all time. Couldn't agree more. Moss absolutely deserved that championship in 58. And Which is the one final point about the Van Wall is that, yeah, it's the first British manufacturer to win. It's a hugely significant moment, especially if you read the Daily Telegraph in the history of motorsport. But actually, the most important car on the grid at the time was also British. And that was the Cooper T43/T45, which Moss also drove on occasion. The first ever rear-engined Formula One car. And once that fundamental design decision was reached, the sport never looked back. Probably the most important Formula One car of all time. But in terms of the 50s context, the Van Walls are iconic, and with good reason.
As always, we always learn some very important lessons from your segments, Joe, about some pretty iconic parts of Formula One's history. But if we're going to talk about Formula One icons, Tony Brooks was a British racing driver who participated in 39 Formula One World Championship Grand Prix from 1956 to 1961. He competed for Connaught, Van Wall, BRM and Ferrari, winning 9 Grand Prix in an era that featured Fangio and Moss. Tony died in May 2022 at the age of 90. Today, producer Roy Field speaks to Tony's daughter, Carrie, about his life and growing up as the daughter of a Formula One driver.
It's the German Grand Prix on the fantastic Avis circuit in Berlin. The race is run in two sections and involves over 300 miles of the fastest driving in the world. It was on this steeply banked corner that Jean Berra was killed in the sports car Grand Prix the day before. The race was a walkover for Ferraris. Tony Brooks, Dan Gurney and Phil Hill finished first, second and third. Britain's Tony Brooks broke the lap record. His average was over 146. He's now just behind Brabham for the World Championship.
Hello, this is producer Roy Field. I have a very special and dear friend, and she has a wonderful link to the sport that we love, Formula One. Her name is Carrie Brooks, and she's the daughter of Tony Brooks, who was the first Brit to win a race in a British car in the 1950s, which is the first time since the 1920s. The sport had been dominated by the Germans and then in the 1950s by the Italians, that when Tony Brooks won in a Van Wall in 1957 along with Stirling Moss, it broke the mould and really set in place British dominance of Formula One, which has never really relinquished ever since. Tony Brooks was a wonderful driver, but unfortunately he passed away just last month. So it's really great to have his daughter Carrie with us today. Carrie, you are the daughter of a famous Formula One driver. Growing up, were you aware of how special and how unique your father was?
Well, I grew up sort of spending a lot of my childhood in the pits. So my childhood memories involve smell of oil, petrol and burnt rubber, which was very much there. And I remember when I was very young, being there very little. I mean, I must have been about 2 or something when Jim Clark was racing as well. And those days, you know, you had a lot of access. I was actually sort of, you know, holding my mum's hands in the pits, being sort of meters away from the cars coming in. It was just part of growing up.
Tell us how your father got into motorsport. What was his story?
So my grandmother was one of these very, very wild British women who sort of rode horses very fast, drove cars very fast. And she had an Austin Healey, which was quite a sort of a little race car at that time. And my dad started racing in that Austin Healey. And that was the beginning of his career.
So he has kind of speed within his DNA because of his mum. What did he tell you about the early 1950s and being, let's say, in Formula 2 before he actually gets to Formula 1?
There's quite a famous story about him because he was studying dentistry. When he got the call from Connaught to go and race in the Syracuse Grand Prix, he was completely unknown, sort of getting into the Connaught car, racing against Mercedes and the teams that were at the top in the 50s. And he went and won. And it was just this complete sort of, who is this guy? Where did he come from?
So your dad raced in an era where he was up against Fangio and Moss, totally iconic names. Did these become like family friends? Was your dad hanging out with Stirling Moss? And if so, do you remember?
mum and dad were very, very close to Fangio. I mean, my mum's Italian, first of all, and they were very close to Fangio indeed, and Stirling Moss, and also, I mean, Graham Hill. I know it's a later stage, but I used to play with Damon Hill when I was little. It is a club, a driver's club. And the thing to remember in the 50s is that, you know, there's a very good documentary called The Killing Years. And it was The Killing Years because you took your life in your hand. And many of my dad's contemporaries died on the circuit. I mean, if you go back in the stories of him having to drive past cars burning in flames and things like that, and the accidents that he had as well, because you did mention my dad winning with Stirling Moss the British Grand Prix in the Vanwall. Well, he had to stop because of the injury that he'd got, you know, in a previous race. And it was sort of life and death in those days. It was what I call gladiatorial.
So your father won races for Vanwall and also for Ferrari, and he raced for Connaught as well. Tell us about that family move, because Formula One was very different then. It very much was a cottage industry in the 1950s. Can you tell us a little bit about that move to Italy? Because your mother is Italian. There's a real sense, because I know you, that as British as you are, you're also incredibly Italian. So tell us about your father's move to Italy driving for Ferrari, and then maybe how that helped shape the family and the family's dual nationality.
Very much dual nationality. I mean, my dad did drive for Ferrari, won Grand Prix and things for Ferrari, and they sort of never forget you. And the fact that he had an Italian wife was a big, big plus. He, in fact, because of all the Italian relatives that he had who don't speak a word of English and still don't speak a word of English, he had to teach himself Italian. So he got himself a Teach Yourself Italian book. And as my dad, that's very single-minded. He sat down and taught himself Italian. And actually, he spoke very good Italian and understood. And so as a family, we grew up speaking two languages. So we jumped from one to the other all the time. And, you know, the fact that my mum was Latin and Italian was very important to him. He went to a Jesuit boarding school and it was very English and very reserved. So you can't get more opposite than a full-blooded Italian woman.
Did your father have any stories about Enzo Ferrari? Because at that point, Enzo Ferrari very much was in control of the Ferrari team.
Yeah, he was Mr. No Nonsense. I mean, my dad, the few times that he did talk about him, he said, yes, he was Mr. No Nonsense. He knew exactly what he wanted. He was like the Godfather. No messing, exactly knew what he wanted.
Ah, Carrie Brooks, thank you for coming on to the Race Directors podcast and sharing some recollections of your father, Tony Brooks.
Thank you.
Ladies and gents, that was a taster for a longer interview that will be out in a very special show next week, where we go into much more depth into Tony Brooks' life and his career. And I, for one, really enjoyed that. I don't know about you gents, but I thought that was fabulous. Joe?
I was lucky enough to speak to Carrie Brooks a few days ago on Clubhouse with producer Roy Field. And make no mistake, before the end, she made sure to get it in to both us and indeed our audience that she is a massive Ferrari fan and always has been, which I know runs Roy Field in particular up the wrong way as a classic Team Lotus boy. But no, she's fantastic. And hearing her emotions in response to like the old British Pathé highlight clips and just, you know, her father. The thing that always gets me about him, he was a fantastic Formula One driver, but we only ever had one German Grand Prix at the Arvest track, which for me is the craziest Grand Prix track of all time. One side of an autobahn, then the other, and a massive banking with no guardrail at the top. Tony Brooks won that race. Like, it takes balls to even get in a car at that track, let alone to win it at the average speed he did. So yeah, nothing but respect, and Carrie's a lovely human being.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it was a very touching interview on her father, who diced with disaster every weekend and managed to do tremendous things in a Ferrari and arguably should have been world champion if it weren't for heroics of Cooper and Jack Brabham in 1959 when he pushed a car over the line to win the championship. So it was lovely to hear about who Tony Brooks was really really was as a man, because he was, from what I've read in motorsport, was a very reserved gentleman. And of course, in the time when he moved to Italy, this was an era where there was no such thing such as Google Translate or Duolingo or anything like that. You had to learn it by your own memory and looking through, learn yourself Italian books. So it was lovely to hear about Carrie's recollections of her father. And of course, the days in the '50s when, you know, you didn't have to pay £2,000 for a paddock pass. You could just turn up, pay 20 quid on the door, and hey presto, you were in mingling with the likes of Jim Clark, Graham Hill, Sterling Moss, or Jose Fuelon Gonzalez or Banjo. So yeah, I enjoyed listening to that.
Well, as I said, lots more to come next week from that interview, but from Formula One icons to the exact opposite, it's time for Plonker of the Week. My favourite part of the podcast. Will Ed choose a driver or someone that has something to do with things that aren't catering? We're about to find out. Ed, who is your Plonker of the Week? Please don't be a caterer.
There's a number of nominees this weekend. It's the Tifi, the traffic system. But I will give it to an entire province this weekend. It goes to the province of Alberta, whose brightest and finest will spend most of their weekend moaning about Sebastian Vettel's helmet, which was supposed to about raise awareness of oil sands, which are damaging the environment. And most of their brightest spend all weekend crying about a man who doesn't have social media's helmet. So a great tourist image for Alberta. Don't go there, it appears to be the case. So you are my Plonker of the Week. Stop crying.
Well, at least it wasn't someone responsible for making the sandwiches. But I'm going to say, Ed, I wouldn't try going to Alberta after this. I think you might be banned. Just a little bit banned.
Who cares?
Cue hate mail from Alberta by the truckload. Good times for the Race Directors podcast. Joe, Plonker of the Week?
I mean, in defence of Ed, there is absolutely sod all in Alberta worth seeing. It's one of the worst Canadian provinces. I'd rather go to Nunavut than there, quite frankly. However, I'm not going to be popular in Canada either, because my Plonker of the Week, it's pretty simple. Nicholas Latifi. Just off the pace all weekend. No excuse to be anywhere near that far off Alexander Albon in qualifying. Race performance was pretty abysmal as well. It was only because of the safety car that he was anywhere near the surrounding pack towards the finish. Yeah, just on a weekend where you're speculated to potentially be out of the sport, whether or not we believe that, you need to put in a better performance than that. And yet again, there's just no sign that this guy is going to be on the pace before the end of the season.
Well, I mean, thank you for choosing a driver. That's a unique treat for us. I am going to choose the McLaren pit crew for that abominable stop with Daniel Ricciardo and Lando Norris, for not knowing what tyres to put on the car, for making a complete hash of it. I know that Lando wasn't exactly on the pace and fighting for anything particularly exciting, but my goodness, that was an absolute car crash. So they get my vote. And as per usual, we stand divided on Plonker of the Week and we do not have a winner. But it was nice to hear from you all. Neither of you should attempt to enter Canada, specifically Alberta, anytime soon. Please steer well clear, because I think they'll be coming after you with pitchforks, chaps, if you do try to enter. But that is all we've got time for this week on the Race Directors podcast. Do check out our YouTube channel, search for us and subscribe to the Race Directors podcast. You can watch some of our exclusive content. And if you want to get involved in the show, do follow us at @race_directors on Twitter, or like us on Facebook at the Race Directors podcast, where we'll be posting memes, updates and our thoughts and feelings throughout the season and beyond. Do give us a little subscribe on whichever platform you choose to listen to the podcast on. We appreciate your support as always. And we will see you next week for a very special show. Say goodnight, gents.
Bonsoir, bonsoir.
Good night, everybody, unless you're from Alberta.
Ed, also, if you think I haven't noticed that you've been eating a McDonald's the whole way through this recording,
I have to eat. It was my dinner. So.
Yeah, but you didn't have to make me jealous.
I'd like to clarify that I have not eaten. I've not eaten a damn thing. So
I have to eat.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.